KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up in this morning's second hour of Forum, historian Neil Ferguson joins us. He is Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of History at Harvard and Senior Research Fellow of Jesus College at Oxford, as well as a Senior Fellow of Stanford's Hoover Institution. His newest book is A New History of the Violence of the Last Century, called The War of the World. And he'll join us on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's Forum. Historian Neil Ferguson holds what I've described as a kind of trifecta of academic posts. He is Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of History at Harvard and a Senior Research Fellow of Jesus College at Oxford, as well as a Senior Fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution. He's also the author of a number of best-selling books, Paper and Iron, The House of Rothschild, The Pity of War, The Cash Nexus, and Empire and Colossus, which he discussed with us on Forum, and a recently published work called The War of the World, which essentially rethinks the 20th century and the violence that was so excessive and pervasive in it in historical terms. He's also a columnist for the Daily Telegraph and the Los Angeles Times and joins us here in studio for Forum Second Hour. And good to see you again.
Welcome. Nice to be back, Michael.
Well, the origins of 20th century violence, what a topic to take on, often seen in terms of ideology or in terms of changes of weaponry, but not by Neil Ferguson. I mean, in terms of the major factors or the preeminent factors, I should just outline for listeners, you're talking about economic instability, you're talking about, again, empire, decline of empire, and something based on those two, ethnic hatred.
Yeah, the question for me was, why were some places so much more violent than others, and some years much more violent than others? Because all the other theories, the ones you just alluded to about extreme ideology or technology, don't really work to answer that question about location and timing, because clearly the technology is more or less ubiquitous, becomes more destructive over time. And the ideologies are there. Most of the extreme ideologies of the 20th century are available in the late 19th century. So we have a puzzle. And the puzzle is that some countries, take, for example, Ukraine, are way more violent than, say, California. And some years, let's say 1944, are just crazily more violent than practically any year in the 1960s. So there's a real puzzle that I wanted to resolve. And the more I thought about it, and this book has been a long time in the making, the more I began to see that you needed at least three different things to explain the timing and location of extreme violence. And you very kindly rattled them off there. One is economic volatility. It's definitely when things are going up and down and all over the place economically that you're more likely to see trouble. And we live in a time of extraordinarily low economic volatility. I mean, we're almost forgetting what a recession feels like. Go back to the time of hyperinflation in the early 20s and deep depression in the 30s, and you're in a very different world. And so I argue that the timing is explained, at least in part, by economics. Then you've got this issue of ethnic disintegration, which I think is in some ways the very core of the book. It's the breakup of multi-ethnic societies in places like Central and Eastern Europe.
That you see this backlash against assimilation and integration.
Yeah. Right, and this is the most troubling part of the book's argument, troubling to me certainly. I started to realize that you couldn't explain the Holocaust in terms of long-standing, deep-rooted eliminationist anti-Semitism, to use a phrase of another historian, because in the 1920s, levels of intermarriage, rates of intermarriage between German Jews and German Gentiles reached unprecedented heights. In fact, there was more assimilation and integration going on in 1920s Germany than in the United States at the same time. So we have a problem. I mean, clearly, not all Germans were consumed with hatred for Jews. There were clearly many who loved the Jews to whom they married. And I wanted to try and make an argument about a breakdown of assimilation, a backlash against it, which I think is one of the core interesting arguments in the book. We tend to assume, don't we, that assimilation and integration are kind of linear processes, and once they get going, they're self-reinforcing, and everybody ultimately is in the melting pot, and they all live happily ever after. But I don't think that's the case. In fact, what we see when we look at Central and Eastern Europe is a very rapid process of assimilation and integration, and then a violent backlash against it, which leads to genocidal violence.
But the violence is so excessive. I mean, when you look at the 20th century, of course, you're looking at this nightmare, unprecedented violence. As you point out, also paradoxically unprecedented progress and movement forward, which I think we have to, of course, figure into the equation. But when I studied these things, the thing that was emphasized most was nationalism,
right?
You know, the fervent nationalism, as opposed to, let's say, empires, longer standing, as you point out, the nation states. But nevertheless, this is the era of the rise of nationalism.
Yes, nationalism certainly is a pretty important part of the story, though, of course, nationalism was a very well-established force in the mid-19th century. It wasn't a 20th century invention. But what is interesting about the period that I focus on is the way that nation states were beginning to supplant empires in a way they never had before. In parts of the world like Central and Eastern Europe, or indeed in East Asia, there's a transition from multinational empires, which are relatively ramshackle structures in many ways. I mean, think of the Habsburg Empire, which was multilingual, multi-ethnic, and really very complex in terms of jurisdiction. After the First World War, the model is self-determination. Nobody did more to propose that than the American president Woodrow Wilson. And the peacemakers set about trying to create nation states out of Czechoslovakia and indeed out of Poland, which hadn't existed as a state since the 18th century. The trouble is, and this is really what brings us back to ethnicity, that in all of these places, communities are far too heterogeneous and mixed up for a nice homogenous nation state to be possible. I mean, in fact, 30% or more of the population of Czechoslovakia and Poland belong to ethnic minorities. So nationalism is a theory that collides with the reality of, if you like, an ethnic patchwork. And as soon as you create nation states in these places, huge tensions spring up between the majority, who are particularly likely to be in charge, and the minority, who suddenly find themselves much more vulnerable than they'd been under the old imperial order. And I think that's another key point that the book makes. It's when empires give way to nation states, rather paradoxically, that violence tends to escalate. And very often the result isn't a harmonious new order, but civil war.
Talking again with Neil Ferguson, his new book is The War of the World, and some revisionist and heterodoxical views in this book that we ought to talk about.
I'm always very nervous of that word revisionist because it's sometimes
misused. Well, it's associated with revisionist of the Holocaust.
Right,
but
which
no,
I
the generic word
stress.
For a historian
yeah,
says
yeah,
we both
yeah.
understand.
I hasten to stress that this book actually yes. deals with the Holocaust. It's very central to the book and tries to look not only at that most extreme episode of ethnic or racial conflict, but to relate it to others, like, for example, the genocide against the Armenians and some of the less well-known genocidal policies pursued by Stalin's Soviet Union.
Well, you take us right up to Yugoslavia and Rwanda,
right,
really.
Exactly.
As well.
I don't mean to suggest that this has
propinquity to the Holocaust.
Right.
I was merely using the word in its old generic
yes,
meaning.
Yes, thank you.
A new historian yeah. or a new historical view. And one is that if Neville Chamberlain, the British Prime Minister, had preemptively attacked, a phrase that also has new meaning
yeah.
behind it, with Iraq and so forth, in 1938, as opposed to signing, it would have been a very different world.
Well, I've always been fascinated, Michael, by counterfactual what-if questions. I mean, I wrote a whole book asking what if the British had stayed out of World War I. And right at the heart of this book, there's a kind of inversion of that, because in 1938, there was an opportunity for Britain to confront Nazi Germany over the question of Czechoslovakia and the Sudetenland, the German speakers in Czechoslovakia. And three times the British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain flew to Germany to try to avoid conflict, to arrive at a negotiated deal, which in effect broke up Czechoslovakia and ceded a large chunk of it, its territory, to Germany. And I argue that that was a mistake, and that it would in fact have been much better if Chamberlain had played hardball and had given Hitler the war that Hitler actually wanted. I mean, Hitler was very disappointed not to have a war in 1938. But I think I show that if he'd had it, he would have been in a really weak position. He wasn't secured to the east because he hadn't yet reached the Nazi-Soviet pact with Stalin. His economic position was pretty flaky, and militarily, there was no way that the Germans were ready for a full-scale war in 1938. So it was a great lost opportunity to get the war over with. And I think if it had happened in 1938, it would have been a much smaller war than the war, of course, that broke out a year later.
Looking again at this counter-history for a moment, or revisionist way of looking at history through counter-history, there's a radical new view that comes across also about World War II in your work, the closeness of victory for the Germans and the Japanese.
Well, they do tremendously well in the opening phase of the war. We, of course, assume with the benefit of hindsight that the Allies were bound to win, given the sheer scale of American economic resources and Russian manpower. Didn't look that way in 1942. In 1942, if you look, for example, at the diaries of Allenbrook, who was the chief of the Imperial General Staff, the most senior military officer in Britain, he's filled with gloom and despondency. He thinks it's all over for the British Empire. And if Hitler can only get his hands on the oil fields of the Caucasus and even conceivably the Middle East, then the war will be won by the Axis. And I wanted to try and recapture that terrifying possibility, which we, I think, all too often dismiss in history books. This was not this, in a sense, wasn't a foregone conclusion. There was a very good chance, actually, for the Axis to win the war. And I think that's part of what's so chilling about the subject. You start to see that Hitler's plans for a new world order came terribly close to being fulfilled.
A friend of mine attended a talk you gave last night and was very taken and charmed by the talk, I should add, but said maybe it's the fact that Professor Ferguson was born in 1964, because apparently, and maybe I'll get you on record as refining what he thought he heard, but what he thought he heard was that World War II was not so much this good versus evil morality player, this Manichaean split and dichotomy that we learn in the West and we learn certainly in America, and that the participation in Nuremberg, the Russian participation in Nuremberg seemed to maybe taint it, despite the fact that it was perhaps morally valid from most points of view. I mean, maybe I can get you on record on those two points.
Well, I talk about a tainted victory because I do think there's a tendency these days for us to romanticize World War II and imagine that it was just democracy versus totalitarianism, good guys against bad guys. I think this is promoted by Hollywood. The transformation of the war into a morality tale is a well-established tradition, and I suspect Flags of Our Fathers is the next installment
the Clint Eastwood
in
film,
this
yeah,
saga.
At Iwo Jima.
Which I haven't seen yet, but which I've in a sense, picked up vibes about. The problem is that we fought this war on the same side as Stalin's Soviet Union after Hitler launched his invasion. And Stalin's Soviet Union was a tyranny every bit as murderous, indeed numerically more murderous, than Nazi Germany. And of course, it was really, in large measure, a war between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union that determined the outcome of the war. Many, many more Russians and Ukrainians are killed fighting Hitler than Americans or Britons. So I think we need to recognize that this is a war in which we ally ourselves with a totalitarian regime to defeat another totalitarian regime. And the outcome of the war is that the Soviet Union is a very substantial beneficiary of victory, not only in Eastern Europe, but also in Asia. So there was a monumental hypocrisy about having Soviet judges at Nuremberg denouncing what, after all, was the premeditation of the war. That was the principal charge leveled against the Nazi leaders. When the Soviets had been on the Nazi side in 1939, they had premeditated the partition of Poland just as much as Hitler had.
This is real politic. I suppose you could make the analogy today of having allies like the Saudis and the Egyptians, both totalitarian regimes, in terms of adversaries in the Middle East. No?
I think that's not an entirely bad analogy. I recently coined the phrase axis of allies, as opposed to the axis of evil, to point out that if one really wants to ask who was responsible for 9/11 in terms of the perpetrators, they were from countries allied to the United States, not from the countries identified by President Bush as members of the Axis of Evil. Yes, it is realpolitik, and nobody, I think, can deny that this was a preferable outcome in 1945 to an Axis victory, no question. But I think we should think in terms of the lesser evil when we talk about 1945, not a triumph of good over evil. I think that is to disguise the reality of what, in fact, was going on. And remember,
keep Stalin out of the picture, it might be, though, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. But you can't keep Stalin out of the picture. I mean, Stalin's army is pouring into Germany, raping and pillaging as it advances, and establishing a tyranny over most of Eastern Europe, including Poland, the country that we had initially gone to fight to defend. It's not the outcome that the good guys initially said they wanted. There's another moral point which is often forgotten, and that is the extent to which the Western powers compromised themselves in the way that they waged the war. That strategic bombing as a strategy for ending the war, the systematic killing of civilians with air power, was something that in the 1930s British and American politicians had denounced as barbaric. But that was the strategy that was adopted to win the war just a few years later. So it was a tainted victory, and I don't think we should romanticize it and overlook the moral compromises that were made.
Talking to Neil Ferguson again, his newest book is called The War of the World. This is also, in many ways, somebody's asking me about your book, and I said it's sort of neo-Spenglerian. That sounds, you know, terribly academic and maybe even pedantic, but it is about the decline of the West and the Asian resurgence, and it's a dominant motif of the last century.
Well, I certainly don't take Oswald Spengler too seriously, but I do allude to his work in the subtitle of the book. I mean, 20th Century Conflict and the Descent of the West is definitely a Spenglerian title. And the point I'm trying to make is that we're wrong to think of the 20th century in terms of the triumph of the West or as an American century, because 1900 was the zenith of Western power. I mean, it was in 1900 that the European empires plus the United States pretty much ruled the world, and they ruled all of Asia, with the exception of Japan. So the majority of the world's population were under some form or other of Western rule. And I think it's downhill from then on.
It begins with the Russo-Japanese War.
Yeah, 1904 is the first moment in over a century when an Asian power successfully defeats a European empire. And the Russo-Japanese War is fascinating because it also focuses attention on another part of the world, which was fantastically dangerous during the 20th century, namely Manchuria-Korea, which is really what the war was fought about. That's another of these places where empires collide. And I see these zones of conflict as being preeminently zones of imperial conflict. So Russia, Japan, and a declining China are all, in a sense, mixed up in this region. And I think it's from then on, from 1904 onwards, that you can see a resurgence of Asia after really a very long period in which Asia had been eclipsed economically, politically, culturally, by extraordinarily powerful expansionist Western empires.
I'll get back to the history in a moment, but you had a piece that certainly provoked a great deal of intellectual interest in Time magazine on the anniversary of 9/11, and you were talking about the geopolitical configuration, and suddenly it was as if empires had shifted, and we've got new hegemony with Russia, sort of the surprise player here, China and Iran. Also President Mark Warren. I guess he just dropped out, though.
Yes, well, I was asked to write the history of the future by the editor of Time magazine. He said, we'd like you to imagine how we'll write and think about 9/11 30 years after the event. And of course, this is an absurd exercise, as I remember saying to him. You know, there are multiple plausible futures, and whichever one we pick will very quickly diverge from the actual.
We've got President Jim McCain, the son of
I had long agonies about who was going to win the various presidential elections, and I have to tell you that piece went through multiple iterations. There were many drafts. One day I will publish the secret unpublished version, which had very different election outcomes, I should say. But at any event,
but you're dead serious, it seems, to be about the possibility of the American empire fading in its hegemony to this new alliance, trio, whatever you want to call it, axis of whatever.
I mean, we may not be able to predict election outcomes, but we certainly can say with, I think, some degree of certainty that the world is reverting to being a multipolar world, that it's no longer one hyperpower and that also RANs. I mean, the economics of energy are making this happen. The sheer leverage that Russia gets out of high oil and gas prices, and, of course, the wealth that flows to Iran for the same reason. These factors are making Russia and Iran very much more powerful than they were, say, in the 80s and 90s. And I think we're seeing, in that sense, a return to some rather familiar patterns of global power. After all, Iran, or Persia, as it used to be known, is one of the world's great imperial powers, and so too is Russia. And China, need hardly say, here on the West Coast, is emerging as, once again, one of the world's great empires. I think the United States is no longer really the only hyperpower on the block, and we're heading towards a time in which the balance of power will look much more, I suppose, like it did in the 19th century, like it did at the beginning of my period, when there were multiple empires, sometimes in alliance with one another, but then sometimes fatally in conflict with one another.
Speaking of your period, you characterize this whole period from 1904, Russo-Japanese War, to 1953 as the Age of Hatred. Why do we stop at 53?
Well, I wanted to get away from the old periodization. I should say that I initially was going to write a book about World War II, and at core, this still is very much a book about World
War
II.
Yes, it is.
But what I began to realize as I thought about it was that nothing really makes the years 1939 to 45 that different from the years before and the years immediately afterwards. There's a real continuum of violence in Asia from the early 30s, when Japan begins to make inroads into China, right the way through to the end of the Korean War. And so I wanted to suggest that from the vantage point of the majority of the world's population in Asia, 39 to 45 really isn't a meaningful period. We really need to talk about 31 or 37 through to 53. And then I began to think, wait a second, maybe starting in the early 30s doesn't make much sense either. We need to look back to 1914 and the huge explosion that begins, I think, the end of globalization. And then I thought, hang on a second, 1914 isn't a significant date necessarily, because really this conflict is brewing in the Balkans for several years before that. And then the Russo-Japanese War hit me as a real historic turning point, the beginning, I think, of that reorientation of the world as Asian power begins to revive. So there is a continuum, I think. And the interesting thing about this period from 1904 to 53, this 50 years war, is that it's very localized, that the most of the fighting happens at the two ends of Eurasia, you know, Central and Eastern Europe at one end, and then Korea, Manchuria at the other end. After 53, those zones of conflict are off limits.
And the Cold War becomes World War III.
And the Cold War was a hot war in places beyond Eurasia. I mean, this is one of the key points I wanted to make, that there really was a Third World War if you were in Cambodia, if you were in Angola, if you were in Guatemala. Violence didn't just kind of stop during the Cold War. I always was amazed at that characterization of the Cold War as a long peace by an eminent American historian. It's not peaceful at all. It's peaceful in the sense that the superpowers don't go head-to-head, though they nearly do a couple of times, but they wage lots of smaller wars by proxy. And I think reviving and reassessing those proxy wars makes us see that levels of violence remained very high right the way through the 50s, 60s, and into the 1980s. So that becomes a kind of epilogue to the book. Let's rethink the Cold War. In that period, violence is relocated. It's no longer in those zones of conflict I talked about earlier. But it's still pretty nasty if you're unlucky enough to be, say, in Guatemala.
We should also mention that Neil Ferguson makes the point in a lot of his writing that the breakup of empire and genocidal hatred, that is really the key to a lot of what he's writing about in his new book, is being seen in the new Middle East and the whole configuration and battles that are going on there. It's almost, again, the cliche of history repeating itself. I want to open the phone lines and bring our listeners into this conversation. It's a broad conversation. It's a really wide canvas of history in the new book, but really with some new views, it seems to me, some of those counter-history views. In fact, one of them also has to do with the fact that if Hitler had won World War I, there would have been perhaps less violence through the 20th century. These are, again, what I was referring to as kind of counter-historical and maybe revisionist views, as some might see it. In the old generic sense of that word. You are welcome to join this program. Lines are available to you, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. We welcome your calls, and you can phone us now at our toll-free number, which is 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free and lines available to you, 866-733-6786. If you'd like to join us in conversation with Neil Ferguson, you can also email us any thoughts you have or questions, and our email address here is forum@kqed.org. Professor Ferguson will be at Book Passage in Corte Madera this evening at 7 o'clock, but he's here with us for the rest of this hour, so if you have something you'd like to query, ask him, say to him, join us. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour with Neil Ferguson. He'll be at Book Passage in Corte Madera this evening. He was recently voted by Time Magazine as one of the world's 100 most influential people and still maintains his Scottish humility in spite of that. Glad to have you here also.
Yes, I think I've stopped being influential. That was in 2004, and since then my influence has clearly plummeted.
Well, no, it maintains itself. In fact, we're talking a little bit off air about the fact that there's always an attempt to kind of pigeonhole you. A lot of the British press said, well, he's right of center. I guess it goes back to maybe some of your young man's enthusiasm for Margaret Thatcher. But it's also interesting how that can kind of be pinned onto something like what you say about Al-Qaeda. And what you say, I think, is worth our listeners hearing. That is that Al-Qaeda, despite its being called Islamo-fascist, even by President Bush at one point, really represents a more... Al-Qaeda is closer, and Bin Laden closer to Lenin than to Hitler. It's internationalist, it's revolutionary, it's anti-capitalist.
Right. I call it Islamo-Bolshevism because actually when you read Bin Laden's public statements, they're far closer rhetorically to Lenin than they are to, say, Hitler or Mussolini. Fascism is about nation states. It is an extreme brand of nationalism. It doesn't have the kind of international aspirations that Al-Qaeda and the Bolshevik Party clearly had. I do think that they aim at world revolution. The difference is that they, instead of waving Marxist Das Kapital, they wave the Quran around. But I do sense that we're misunderstanding this phenomenon by trying to couch it in World War II terms. I'm really hostile to this use of World War II rhetoric. Donald Rumsfeld only the other day talked about appeasement, and Islamofascism very much fits into this this mode, because I don't think we're refighting World War II at this point. We're dealing with something which is rather more like the Bolsheviks pre-1917. It's a global network of extremely radical political cells willing to use terrorism in pursuit of their aims. Everything will change if they gain control of a major state, just as everything changed in 1917 when the Bolsheviks gained control of the Russian Empire.
One might argue that in the Sudan they have.
Well, I think you can argue that they're making gains all the time. I mean, you could imagine they're taking over Pakistan in the foreseeable future. And the nightmare scenario from American policy's point of view is the takeover of Saudi Arabia. I mean, the potential for Bin Laden to proclaim an Islamic Republic of Arabia in our lifetimes is very real. And at that point, I think we'll really be into the kind of post-1917 type world when suddenly these people control a major state. But I'm glad you raised this issue of politics, because I get very bored of being pigeonholed as a right-wing historian when, in many ways, when I come to the United States, I feel as if I'm a liberal born and bred, that the political spectrum here is so different from that back in Europe, that things that are conservative in my country are generally quite liberal here. And the things that are conservative in the United States don't really exist in Europe anymore. So it's not a helpful label. And I don't think it really illuminates my work as a historian at all.
Before we get to your calls here, I just want to go back to something else historically. The ubiquity of violence and the iniquity of violence in the 20th century and the horrors. And you talk about this. I just mentioned the Sudan, so it came to mind. You talk about mass sexual assault and its tie with modern warfare. I mean, we certainly saw it in the Balkans. We saw it in Darfur. We see it ongoing in Darfur. And again, you see this pretty much in terms of the whole picture that you provide us here.
Well, I think one of the striking features of the extreme episodes of violence that I describe is how often sexual violence becomes a part of the story. A lot of 20th century violence is directed against civilians. It's not directed against other men in uniform. And it's, in a sense, you see a breakdown of the laws of war occurring, particularly during World War II, but not only then. I mean, the Armenian genocide is accompanied with acts of rape directed against Armenian women.
Turks continue to say there was no Armenian genocide.
Yeah, this is a fascinating subject because it is live news. I mean, people are threatened with prosecution in Turkey for using the term genocide. I think one of the things I tried to do in this book was to write in a very detailed way something about that episode. There's no question that genocidal policy was adopted by the Young Turk regime during the First World War. And the detail in this is one of, I hope, one of the selling points of the book. If you really want to get this story straight, if it makes you uneasy, I hope I've got as near to a kind of definitive overview as it's possible to get. I spent a huge amount of time on those few pages because it just seemed to me hugely important. It's the first modern genocide when people are being put onto cattle trucks and systematically driven from their homes, taken to places where they can be killed or left to die. And that scenario, that sequence of events, repeated itself again and again. With, as I've said, this extraordinary leitmotif of sexual violence. Think of the Japanese rape of Nanjing.
The Korean women, too. Yeah.
And the enslavement of Korean women, their use as prostitutes, enslaved sexual prostitutes. It's an extraordinary theme, I think, in 20th century conflict that doesn't get written about enough.
We'll bring our callers on. Ashima, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to say I'm a citizen of India and I was born 3 decades too late, because if I had been born 3 decades earlier, I would have been a subject of the British Empire. So I'm somewhat mystified by Professor Ferguson's thesis that the decay of empire in multicultural communities and conditions of economic boom and bust is a recipe for genocidal hatred. So then how do you account for the non-disintegration of India? How do you account for the idea of India and the idea of a resolutely non-Western, a resolutely pluralist democracy? And again, thank you for taking my call. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you for the call.
Ashima, India did disintegrate. You're forgetting 1947. The end of British rule was accompanied by what was euphemistically called partition, which involved vast population transfers and death tolls of the order of 1 million. And I think that illustrates very well my argument that it's when empires decline and fall that violence very often spikes. I think we tend to write this out of the story because we forget that what we call India today was only part of what the British called India, which extended right into and included Pakistan and what is now Bangladesh. So no, I don't quite buy your argument that this falsifies my theory. I actually see it as rather a good illustration of the point.
Again, the paradox here is with all this ethnic hatred and all this violence, there were extraordinary advancements scientifically, politically, materially. There were more democratic republics and governments of one sort or another, burgeoning economic development, human rights. I mean, it's a century that's really quite mixed.
Yeah, this is the huge paradox right at the center of the 20th century that the book tries to grapple with. It was a century of unprecedented economic progress. I mean, the average human being is 5 times richer by the end of the century than at the beginning, and that's only one of many measures that I cite early on in the book. So we have to understand, why could material progress be punctuated so frequently by mass organized violence? Anybody who I think has a simple linear view of progress has to deal with this issue, because clearly this is the difference between, say, the 20th century and the 13th century. I mean, in the 13th century, we know Genghis Khan committed all kinds of acts of astonishing violence, and some people would even say that he probably kills a higher proportion of the world's population than Hitler and Stalin between them were able to do in the 20th century. But, you know, the 13th century wasn't a century of unprecedented economic progress. We're dealing with acts of barbarism in the midst of scientific, political, and economic advance.
And we'll advance to more of your calls. We'll go to Palo Alto. Michael, you're on. Good morning.
Yeah, hi, good morning. Thanks, Mr. Ferguson, for being here. And I would like to hear you talk about the work of Douglas Reed and his book, The Controversy of Zion. He does a pretty good job of exposing the whole Ashkenazi Jewish role in 19th and 20th century and, you know, right up to the present day. Are you familiar with his work?
I'm not, and I've made it a rule, which I'm afraid not all academics abide by, not to talk about books that I haven't read. I'm not quite sure what theory you're alluding to either, so I should be extremely careful.
Sounds like a conspiratorial theory on the face of it, is it?
Well, I just, I think ethnic groups, do have agendas, and there are many ethnic groups, and I think he sheds good light on the role of the Ashkenazi Jewish role in the 19th and 20th century. It's a great book called The Controversy of Zion.
Michael, what you're talking about sounds a little worryingly to me like the kind of thing that inspired some of the worst crimes of the 20th century. There's a long-standing conspiracy theory about the power of the Jews which goes back to the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, a forgery produced in the 19th century Russia. There's a sense in which that this theory that there's one race or one ethnic group bent on world domination is one of the most dangerous theories of the 20th century, and part of what I've tried to do in this book is to show how this theory arises, how it spreads, and how it then becomes the basis for ultimately genocidal policies. So if that's what Douglas Reed is on about, I certainly will read him with the utmost caution, not to say suspicion.
Let me thank the caller, and we'll move on to more of your calls. David, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. I have an interest in comparing the civil war in Greece to the fact that Tito prevented such a war from taking place in Yugoslavia for 50 years. And when he died, then it did take place. And I'm wondering how that could be compared to the situation in Iraq, where Saddam Hussein was preventing such a civil war from taking place, which in fact was an inevitable civil war.
Well, this is a really important question, because what I try and do in the book is to draw some parallels between Central and Eastern Europe, and particularly the Balkans, and the Middle East today, because clearly we're seeing unfolding in Iraq before our very eyes scenes distinctly reminiscent of some of the scenes that we saw not just in the 1990s in Bosnia, but in a more spectacular way in the early 1940s right across the Balkan Peninsula, including, as you rightly say, in Greece, which had an extremely nasty civil war. There's a sense in which what we call World War II in that part of the world was really just a group of related civil wars that were sponsored by the rivals, sponsored by the Axis and the Allied powers. What's happening in Iraq does remind me very much of that scenario, because what we're seeing is that in the absence of the strong man, in the absence of the brutal dictator, Saddam, it should be said, was way more brutal than Tito, there is an escalating civil war between majority Shiite Iraqis and the minority Sunnis, who for so long, really for most of the existence of Iraq, have been politically dominant. Now, this is troubling, because you don't want to end up concluding that there are some parts of the world that just need brutal dictators to be stable. I think a better conclusion is that there are some parts of the world that, if you try to introduce democracy in a great hurry, at a time of military upheaval and economic crisis, you're much less likely to get a happy outcome and much more likely to end up in a civil war. I should say that I don't think this civil war is likely to fizzle out. If anything, at the moment, we're looking at a potential escalation that could produce the worst internecine conflict in the Middle East since Lebanon tore itself apart back in the 70s and early 80s.
Thank the caller, and remind you that we're talking with Neil Ferguson, Lawrence A. Tisch Professor of History at Harvard and resident faculty member of the Minda Day Gunsberg Center for European Studies, also Senior Research Fellow of Jesus College at Oxford, and Senior Fellow of the Hoover Institution at Stanford. His new book is called The War of the World, 20th Century Conflict and the Descent of the West. And again, if you'd like to join the program, you're welcome to do that by phone, toll-free 866-733-6786. Or by email, forum@kqed.org. Here's an email from a listener named Matt who says, had Chamberlain fought in 1938, would the English people have gone willingly, or the French? Would the United States have felt compelled to join? Leaders' choices are quite narrow. They have to do what their public wants. Churchill might have ranted for war in 1938 had he been in charge and been thrown out by his party.
Well, Matt, you'll find this book fascinating, because I go into that question really closely. And one of the interesting things that emerges from some recent research that's been done on British public opinion is how far it had swung between 36 and 38. There was no way you would have got the British public behind a war in 36 when Hitler reoccupied and militarized the Rhineland. But by 38, Chamberlain was in fact politically in some difficulty. And there had been a really marked shift in opinion. And I don't think it's right to portray Churchill as completely isolated. Churchill was being reviled by Chamberlain and his cronies, who conducted a press campaign against him. But in fact, in the House of Commons, and even more importantly, in the country at large, his position had become really very much more popular by the time of the summer of 1938, the critical period when Hitler was willing to risk war over the Sudetenland. So I think there is an argument to be made that the British public was ready to confront Hitler, that they'd already realized that war was coming and that it might be better to tackle him sooner rather than later. France is another matter. And there I think there's a big problem, which British policymakers were going to confront sooner or later. Eventually they confronted it in 1940, and that was the unwillingness of the French to suffer another 1914-style bloodletting. And I think there's a problem that no British politician could really have overcome, to say nothing of American reluctance. I mean, the opinion polls that we have show how reluctant Americans were to be drawn into another European conflict. So I think in 1938, if Britain had adopted a different policy, the British public would have been okay. But I'm not sure there would have been very solid support from France, and I don't think there would have been any support from the United States.
Another listener who wants to know, would you please ask Professor Ferguson to comment on the role played by individuals in these momentous events, the notion that history is made by individuals that comes to the fore rather than by nation states?
Yes, this is an extremely important philosophical question, and I don't want to give your listeners the impression that I think great structural forces are in control of historical events. Key roles are played by individuals. Hitler, Stalin, Mao, not to mention Pol Pot, they all have abundant index entries. But I didn't want to write a book that simply blamed wicked men for the extreme violence of the 20th century. Tolstoy has a very important point that he makes in War and Peace. He says, you know, the interesting thing about the Napoleonic Wars is not that the French are ordered by Napoleon to invade Russia. It's the fact that the Frenchmen obey. And I'm more interested, in a sense, in why people at certain times and in certain places will follow psychopathic leaders and do what they say. Because, to take the case of Hitler, Hitler in 1923 stood up and said, you know, we must engage in a radical resettlement of the post-war order, and the Jews are to blame for all our misfortunes. And he was regarded as a complete idiot. I mean, he really got nowhere politically. But 10 years later, Germany has so been transformed by intervening events that he's a credible figure. And so the book is about, yes, it is about wicked men, and indeed about great men. Churchill certainly gets a fair crack of the whip. But it's also about what makes ordinary people, and I keep trying to dig down to the level of the unsung private soldier or the forgotten housewife. It's why ordinary people listen at certain times to these crazy men. That's what really interests me.
There's a whole kind of new brand of history, and it's come from the left in large part, that tries to look to the individuals who are part of the ordinary quotidian life and see history through their eyes. I'm thinking, you know, particularly leftist historians, but it's certainly part of the landscape now of history.
And I think it's an extremely healthy thing. I mean, part of what I wanted to do in this book was to keep seeing things from the vantage point of the unsung anti-hero. That's why I give a lot of time to Victor Klemperer, who was relatively lowly, though, you know, very intelligent German academic of Jewish origin, caught up in the horrors of Nazi Germany. His diary, which some of your listeners may know in its original form, is a wonderful source for my book, because we see through Klemperer's skeptical, critical eyes the unfolding of the horror of Nazism. And what's very clear when you see it from his vantage point is the salami-slicing quality of Nazi rule. You don't know in 1933 that the road leads to Auschwitz if you're a German Jew living in Dresden. All you have a sense of is that your civil liberties are being somewhat reduced, and with every passing year, they're reduced a little bit more. They take away a little bit more of what you have. But you hang on to the hope that this isn't going to go on forever and that at some point you'll get your country back. Now that, it seems to me, is a very illuminating way of understanding the past, and much better than just reading Mein Kampf and saying, well, Hitler had a plan and he was a mighty and a terrible man and he was able to implement it. That's not very helpful.
Is it helpful, though, to make that analogy when you're looking at individuals and the way they impress and the way they shape history? You look at Ahmadinejad and you see, you know, he has plans. You look at bin Laden, he has plans, as you indicated earlier.
Well, I think the key thing is just to recognize why it is that a figure like Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is able to mobilize support when he calls for the annihilation of Israel, when he makes his or issues his diatribes against American foreign policy. We can't just understand him as some kind of Persian version of Hitler. I think that's a real misreading of history. But what we need to understand is why many young Iranians, particularly outside of the educated classes in Tehran, why they're attracted to this guy, why they like his rather down-home, simplistic style of life, and why they identify with his brand of Shiite religion. I mean, he is a convinced believer that the 12th hidden imam will return at the end of days, and that this is imminent. I find that much more scary than any other thing.
There's a great deal of speculation when they were when they were talking about testing, nuclear testing, that this was somehow tied to that theological.
I don't think we should underestimate that. I mean, one of the things that's important about extreme ideologies is that when they foresee some kind of judgment day, some kind of great reckoning, whether they're secular or religious, because after all, Marxism imagined a great reckoning, great revolutionary moment. That encourages people to believe that the great reckoning is coming and that you ought to help it on. So I get very uneasy when I listen to Ahmadinejad's speeches. He's made two at the UN, both of which have ended with an explicit expectation of the end of days. And people assume this is some kind of monopoly of the religious right in the United States, but I'm afraid many Shiite Muslims buy into exactly the same sort of millenarian fantasy.
I remember when I first read Marx, I thought to myself, because there's always this prescient notion somehow that in the future the state is going to wither away, and I thought, who's going to decide when it's time to wither, and how is it exactly going to wither? How is that going to take place?
Much of what was in Marxism was a kind of caricatured theology in which God had been replaced by the Hegelian historical process.
By dialectics. John, you're on. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, Michael, and good morning, Professor Ferguson. I wanted to comment that he was talking about the decisions that Chamberlain made in 1938. The question is, could Britain have fought a war in 1938, especially without the cooperation of the French? And, of course, I agree with him completely on the French military mindset, which was completely defensive. But if I recall, the Spitfire, for example, which was the great aircraft that enabled Britain to win the Battle of Britain in 1940, was not available to the Royal Air Force in any kind of quantity until 1939. And, of course, all of these countries, because of the Great Depression, had neglected their military establishments. So it's questionable if Britain had the military force in 1938 to fight Nazi Germany, especially without any kind of French cooperation. Also, I have one other comment to make, and that is on this business of the mass bombing of cities and the fact that there was a compromise with the moral equation. It was the Axis powers that started the mass bombing of defenseless cities, Japanese in China, of course, and in 1939, the Germans had no inhibitions about bombing defenseless Warsaw. In 1940, they bombed the city of Rotterdam, even after the Dutch had announced that they were going to surrender. The Allies did the same thing, of course, but they were just much more efficient at it, and they had much far greater resources. So it's whatever when you start something in a war, you cross a certain threshold, then all the warring powers carry out the same activity.
John, thank you for your comments. We'll go to Neil Ferguson.
John, these are really great points, and you're obviously a man who knows his history. The important thing about 1938 is that the Czechs were ready to fight, and most of the fighting would, in fact, have been on the German-Czech frontier. The role that Britain and France, and indeed the Soviet Union, had to play at this point was to make the Germans feel nervous enough to have to deploy substantial numbers of divisions to both their western and eastern frontiers. And that's the important point, that there was a tremendous chance to pressurize Hitler. He didn't have the Nazi-Soviet pact in his pocket in 1938. Litvinov was making it clear that the Soviets would stand by their guarantee to Czechoslovakia. I mean, there was no equivocation there. And the French, too, regarded themselves as being bullied into appeasement by Chamberlain. Daladier feels as if he's really getting the rug pulled out from underneath him by the British government, because he too was ready to contemplate a showdown, far more, I think, than Chamberlain was. So imagine Germany's position. They would have had a real fight on their hands. We know that from the military attachés who looked at this, just in fighting the Czech army. And he would have had to have maintained substantial defensive forces, not only on his western frontier, but on his eastern frontier. Add into that, you've got a potentially serious economic crisis in Germany, all kinds of shortages of munitions, and a mounting crisis of confidence in the German military elite towards Hitler. He was in a much weaker position in the summer of 1938 than he was a year later. And the fatal mistake, John, I think, was that Chamberlain believed 12 months would give Britain time to get ahead. Well, it certainly did give Britain time to build more Spitfires, but it also gave Hitler more time. And this was the fundamental, I think, a failure of comprehension. They didn't seem to see in London that they were giving the 12 months to Hitler too. And by the time war came in 1939, Hitler had made huge advances to secure his position, particularly by doing his deal with Stalin. You also raised a point about bombing, which is, of course,
was there any anticipation of Blitzkrieg, though? That was 1939. Or to what extent was it anticipated?
There were huge fears on the part of the British elite that within minutes, hours of the outbreak of war, London would be bombed flat. we know, and indeed some people at the time knew very well now, that that this was a fantasy. I mean, the Germans had nowhere near enough bombing capability to make a serious strike on London in 1938. So part of the problem, going back to that crisis, was a failure of intelligence. Intelligence was available, but it was not well understood about the nature of the Luftwaffe's strength, partly because the Germans are so good at exaggerating it. They did something that often works very well against a relatively weak opponent, that they wildly exaggerated their striking capability. And in some ways, I think Chamberlain and other conservative politicians fell for it. This issue of bombing cities is really important to understand. I mean, you raise a really critical point, who started it. And certainly the first raids were by the Axis powers. But the raids that they conducted were much smaller than what subsequently followed. I mean, the amount of explosives dropped on Britain by the Germans is trifling compared with the amount of explosives that we then dropped on Germany. So it wasn't just that we retaliated. Let's be clear about this. We retaliated with an order of magnitude more destructive force and leveled entire cities, killing vastly more civilians than the Germans killed on our side.
I think Benjamin Netanyahu reminded a British broadcaster of this when they were talking about the disproportionate use of aerial
It's not a bad point.
Some good points here from our listeners just about, we're almost out of time here, but with literally seconds left here, but I want to know if these cycles of history, or these are cycles of history, and how they, what kind of applications they can have to politics now when the moral lessons ought to be perhaps gleaned or absorbed.
Well, I'm very cautious about cyclical theories of history because they imply a uniformity and predictability about the historical process, whereas I think I would tend to emphasize its somewhat chaotic quality. And this great crisis in the early 1940s is not one that necessarily will repeat itself in 2039 to 2045. History isn't that regular a phenomenon. But I think one thing that is very clear to me is that we need to understand the roots of ethnic conflict much better than we do. What a big mistake it was to think of the post-Cold War world in terms of clashes of civilizations, when the real clashes, the really scary clashes, are within civilizations. And as we watch ethnic conflict escalate in Iraq, we should be saying to ourselves, we should have known much, much more clearly that this was a danger back in 2003. We need to know more history, and our leaders need to know a lot more history when they're making strategic decisions.
What a good reminder and caveat to conclude on. Neil Ferguson, always glad to have you here. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
He'll be at Book Passage in Corte Madera this evening at 8 o'clock. Again, his book is called The War of the World, 20th Century Conflict and the Descent of the West. I want to thank our producers, Robin Giannatasio-Ma, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory, and our interns, Elsa Chang, Barton Kreith, Nagar Godabi, Mike Fisher, Mary Trell, and Leah Wellborn. Also, Forum's engineer is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.